Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey everyone, Chris Evans here with a special pop-up edition of the Best of the Breakfast Show podcast with Sky from Virgin Radio with Marvel's first Asian superhero saying all the right things and using his fame and his world status and his huge platform as nothing but a force for good. I love this guy. His name is Simu Liu. Enjoy.
This former accountant turned blockbuster superhero burst into cinemas last year with Marvel's Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings. His book, We Were Dreamers, is out today and tells his own origin story. Swapping the Hollywood Hills for our London view, it's Simu Liu.
Good morning, Simu. Welcome to the top of the tower.
It is so great to be here, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.
What a story. It's beautifully written. It's very funny. It's very touching. It's very emotive for so many reasons. Let's fast forward. Right to the end of the book, then we'll go back and then we'll have a lucky dip somewhere in between.
Sure.
Let's go to the final audition of you auditioning for the role of Shang-Chi, for Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. Mm-hmm. So the second audition, you say, I can recall pieces of what happened in the room. My reader, Molly's auburn hair, Sarah's smile, Destin, the director, nodding his head in approval, but it all went by in a blur. I think at some point I threw my pages away and just invented a scene in my head. I did know one thing, however, beyond any reasonable doubt, it was the best audition I'd ever done. How did you know that?
Oh man, it's just the energy in the room, you know. I remember, so that passage in the book refers to the callback audition that I did in Los Angeles at Serafin's casting offices. Serafin, of course, is the famous
legend,
the legendary casting director of all of the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies. But I remember I was meeting Destin for the first time, and it's that spark that happens when you've found not only your director but your collaborator. And you know, that thing that I said about throwing away the pages at one point and just inventing a scene, that's totally true. Because Destin saw that I was, you know, on book, I was reading off the page, and he was like, great, just throw away the pages and just say whatever you feel like saying. And we invented, we improvised, and we played around. And by the end of it, I was like, I've never experienced that in an audition room before. And I started to really feel nervous, because before then, I mean, you're auditioning for a Marvel movie. You know, I don't know how many tens of thousands of people had sent in their tapes. So it was really the first time that I was like, oh, geez, I think I might actually have a shot, which means I also have a chance to mess it all up.
Yeah.
And that made me, oh.
Yeah, don't overthink it. Don't get in the way of yourself.
That's
very important, isn't it? But of course, it wasn't the first time you played a superhero. it happened so many times in the past. You're a superhero children's entertainer.
Yes.
Tell us about those days.
Well, it was one of those Joe jobs that you take on. Do you say Joe jobs in Britain?
We do now.
Excellent. We do now. I'm making it happen. It was, you know, during my struggle years as an artist, of course, I'm trying to do everything I can to stay afloat. And, you know, being a Spider-Man, a dress-up Spider-Man for kids' birthday parties, as it happens, pays pretty decently. It's pretty flexible, you know. you get a lot of weekends, I signed up with a company, and you know, for the most part, it's really fun. Like when you know, you have these parents whose children are about 5 or 6. Like, before they start to realize that you're not the actual superhero.
You said 5. Is five the party you want? You want a 5th birthday party?
Oh, my God. Yeah, 5 is great. There are some parents that just do not understand how their children develop.
Yeah.
And will invite a Spider-Man to come to their kid's, like, 8th or 9th birthday.
Yeah.
And that's no good. That's
not
no good.
Because
the kids know. They're just like, why are you doing this?
They
can see the Velcro, exactly. They know there's a man behind there that just, like, is probably just as miserable as they are.
And below sort of 5, they want a clown or something. But 5 is it. 5 is the age.
Oh, 5 is the magic.
You can have them at 5.
Yeah. They will believe. Like, you can feel their belief that you are Spider-Man. And And the only reason you're not shooting webs right now is because you don't want to mess up the home.
Yeah, what mum's done to prepare the party. And then before the kids' superhero window, there was Super Frosh.
Super Frosh.
Tell us about Super Frosh.
Oh my God, you really have read my book. But can I just say how crazy that feels? Because it's one thing to say, I've seen your movie, and I always feel very, very happy about that. But a book is, I mean, it's such an intimate thing. So thanks, all of you guys,
for reading it. The other two claim they've read it, but
they're just pretending.
Yeah, I'm doing all the heavy lifting.
That's fair.
Here,
that's fair.
But I get the big book, so that's
fair. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But the Super Frosh was this talent show in my freshman year of college. And it was really, like I say in my book, it's my first kind of brush with fame. And I was coming off of a pretty mediocre high school experience, as so many of us have. But it was this opportunity for me to redefine myself. And I remember I was sitting in the bleachers with all of these other freshmen, and they were like, come and show your talents on the stage. And, you know, people were coming up and just doing absolutely nothing. Like, one guy threw a chair. That was his talent. And so I was like, look, I'm going to give it a shot, right? So I went up and I did like a backflip, and I remember everyone was like going crazy.
Well, you saw a parting of the ways, didn't you? You saw a space on the floor. You thought, I'm going to have that.
I'm going to take up that space, yes. Very profound.
Yeah, very profound. Yeah.
And that ended up, I ended up being one of the finalists, and then I wound up on stage in front of the entire student body at one point, dancing and singing for some reason, and then I won the Super Frosh, and I was like that guy on campus.
Yeah, but you say you chose, I mean, you know, I think you'd be very modest, but you say you chose a song that everybody joined in with, so maybe you nailed the song choice, as opposed to the singing. I suspect it was a lot of both.
Thank you. I will take that.
Okay. As far as being a real life superhero is concerned, I can't help deducing from the first few chapters of the book, you sort of had to be as a little boy to sustain this mad upbringing that you experienced. Mm. Born in China, mm-hmm. Mum and Dad moved to Canada without you. Mm. You didn't really know they were Mum and Dad. You just thought they were people with grown-up names. Mm-hmm. And then Daddy came to take you from China for this new life in Canada, which you enjoyed up to a point. Mm-hmm. But then you felt the pressure of their projected almost what they wanted for themselves, but they couldn't get it, so they wanted you to have it for them. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. this takes up a lot of the book, and it's fascinating, and you're so candid about it. Mm-hmm. Speak to that if you don't mind first, and then tell us how writing about it and getting it out there has helped you with any kind of closure.
Yeah, of course. Well, you know, it was less, I think, about closure for me, speaking about this, just these kind of intergenerational turmoils that so many of us in immigrant households experience with our parents, right? So I'm very candid about it in the book, as you talked about, because specifically for the reason that so many families are not, you know, and it wasn't born out of this desire to air out dirty laundry and to be vindictive against my parents. But truly, it was a collaborative effort where we sat down and we said, what is a story that we want to tell so that we can help other families? You know, because when I was growing up in my adolescence, my parents and I fundamentally did not understand each other. We butted heads every single day. You know, for my parents growing up from such a vastly different environment than I did, that just couldn't connect to this kid that had all these different problems and was worried about girlfriends and things. You know, they were worried about, you know, will I get to go to school tomorrow? You know, will I get the opportunities to fulfill my full potential? They're just very different ways of life. And so, you know, it just, yeah, it led to a lot of clashing. And we want to share all of the intimate details of what we went through, the arguments that we had, sometimes, you know, things becoming physical. But we want to do that in the interest of showing other families, look, you're not alone. You're not the only people to ever have these problems. There is a path forward, because we have found that path forward. We've reconciled in a very real way. And, you know, we're each other's best friends today. So we want to help guide other families to get there.
Yeah, because the book starts where it ends, doesn't it? It starts at you getting the phone call that would change your life, and they're being sworn to secrecy by the Marvel execs.
Yes.
Saying, you know, if there's one thing you ever do, one secret you ever keep, Simu, it's got to be this one. And you said, absolutely no problem with that.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
put the phone
don't up. Tell
yeah.
anyone.
And you instantly called your best mate, and then you called your folks.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think about it's such a realization of an immigrant dream, you know, that my parents must not have even dared dream when they first came to Canada. You know, I think the expectations were, you know, immigrants coming to a country with no support system, no money in their pockets, just hopes and dreams of building a better life. All you want to do is survive.
Yeah.
And to, I think, watch your next generation not only survive, but getting that kind of recognition and admiration is, you know, it's the best possible gift that I could have given to them,
yeah,
because
your
meant...
mum and dad, you know, their sort of upbringing was all about proving your worth and justifying, yes, your position and saying, look, I deserve to be here. Mm-hmm. But of course, that isn't dreaming. You know, mm-hmm, it is a dream of sorts, but they didn't allow themselves to dream beyond that, which is what you sort of have to do if you want to end up in the business that we're in.
Absolutely.
So you went beyond their... You stood on the shoulders of their dreams,
yes,
to realize yours,
yes,
which was beyond their comprehension almost.
Yes, yes. But you know what? And what they didn't understand at the time when they were, you know, yelling at me for not doing my math homework or not, you know, being an engineer and following in their footsteps, was that their dream, you know, their sacrifices were made so that I could pursue my own.
Yeah.
So that I would have the freedom and the privilege of defining my own success and walking and choosing to walk down that path.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely the gift that they've given me.
It's incredible to think. I mean, you're only, you know, in my world, you're only a baby. You're still only 33 years old.
Thank you for saying that, Chris.
But you really are. I mean, you're a kid. Because you talk about yourself being a kid in the book, mm-hmm, in the early 20s. I think you're still a kid, actually. But that's because I'm twice your age, or almost twice your age. Not quite. But it's, you know, bearing that in mind, it's only the heartbeat of a sparrow since you were still an accountant at Deloitte.
Yeah.
I can't believe that. I was like,
look at I, man.
This is one of the best stories. This is why I loved your book. It's one of the best stories, man. Tell everybody how you we're not yanking their chain. You really were an accountant at Deloitte.
I was an accountant.
Like two days ago.
Yeah. It was 10 years ago, which I guess is a lot longer for me than it is for you.
Yeah.
But
I thought we were getting on.
I know. I don't know why I said that. That came off so aggressive. Well, I graduated from college, and of course, following in some sort of, you know, defined path that was set by my parents, sort of. Like, I was a rebellious kid, but even then, I could never divorce myself from their vision of what success ought to be. And so that's how I ended up at the offices of Deloitte. Hating my life every single day.
Right, really hating.
And for all the accounts, for all the people that are listening right now on their way to work at Deloitte or other accounting firms, that's not to say, look, it just wasn't for me.
Wasn't for you.
And if you love your job, I've nothing but I feel like that's what I want more than anything, is for you to love your job.
I don't think you have to defend it as a point of view. I think they
right.
get it.
But it was terrible. It was terrible. I hated every second.
It was minute by minute, wasn't it? You really detested it.
It was
made you feel sick.
It was like waking up at the last possible second, rolling into the office at the last possible second, and then staring at the clock, trying to make excuses, and you know, every so often, I need to go down, I need to take a walk, I need to get a coffee. It was like, get me out of this.
Yeah.
And then you know, rinse and repeat for about 8 months. And thankfully, one day in April, I was let go of my job less than a year in.
Okay, but you couldn't tell your mum and dad.
No, that would have been rough.
Okay, and you were acting at the time, so you were doing extras work, and you were hanging around for 14 hours with your pals, you know, on various sets of big sort of action movies that mm-hmm. they painted the half of Canada to look like Hong Kong in about a minute, and you thought, this is what I want, I don't care how long I'm going to be here for. But some of these jobs were at the weekend, and then somewhere in the week, and this is how come you got fired. I mean, you know, there's lots of gaps to fill in here, but just buy the book, it's brilliant. Simu Liu, We Were Dreamers, an immigrant superhero origin story. But of course, you know, then... You know, the acting itch started to become ever itchier,
yeah,
and you just had to end up scratching it. So, biggest initial break, would you say? What was your biggest initial break?
God, it was, I mean, it felt like the biggest deal in the world at the time, but I booked a speaking role. My very first speaking role was on a CW show called Nikita. And I played Hong Kong desk cop number one, and I'll do the lines for you right now. So I walk into an interrogation room and I say, Inspector, you have a call from headquarters. And the inspector goes, headquarters? And I say, headquarters, Beijing. End scene.
I liked it.
And it was, yeah,
well, for me.
It was the biggest deal, because I never thought of myself as a working, like, I was just doing it as a hobby to pass the time because I was unemployed. And then, you know, being on set around professionals and being, you know, kind of brought up to that level. I remember I had a scene with Shane West, the actor from A Walk to Remember. It was very big in my childhood. I don't know if you guys are
Walk to Remember fans. You were in disbelief when you were on set with this guy.
Total disbelief. And I was like, you can make a living doing this. And from that point on, I was in.
You were in. And then again, various things happened. One week, Simu found himself earning like $10,000 in 10 days or something like that. But then there was a lean period, you know, and then you got more regular acting work.
Ups and downs, man. Ups and feast downs. And famine.
Yep. Yeah, ride the roller coaster because that's what it's all about, bebe.
Yeah, bebe.
You know, and by the way, the bigger the lows, the more potential, the higher the zeniths are.
Yes.
But then what I love about you is you poured all your money back into acting. So then you started taking acting lessons. Mm-hmm. Just tell us what you learned about that, how things developed, and how that helped you to get to where you are today.
Yeah, well, the classes are really important because otherwise anybody could just kind of walk in and start, you know, acting. And I think it's fine for the one or two liners, but I think I came to the realization very quickly that it was about more than just being on, having a camera pointed at you and looking pretty. There was a real craft to this, and the more I took classes, the more I discovered how much I loved just performing, playing characters, getting deep into the psyche of the characters that I would inhabit. And you think of like any emotionally repressed kid from an immigrant household where talking about your feelings was just like not on the table. All of a sudden I was studying feelings every day, and so it just became so addictive going to acting class and getting to just emote.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, you really had found your lane, hadn't you? You could sense it.
Yeah.
You know, and once, you know, and like you say, I hope people listen to this. If you have a sense of your lane, your true nature, you know, it's so much easier to exist within that as opposed to, you know, often if you're blessed with, you know, loads of energy, you find it easier to keep bashing that universal square peg into a round hole, which is fine. But the second you stop bashing it, it will pop out again. Far better to find your true nature and swim in that lane.
That's beautiful.
And then you got this really quite decent gig in Canada, didn't you? That was a great thing. And then it became a hamstring as well.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, so the show that you're talking about is Kim's Convenience, which is on Netflix all over the world. But it started as a small Canadian show about an immigrant family, which is, you know, so amazing, and was based on a play that was written by a Korean-Canadian playwright. And so it had all of the trappings of this incredible story that, you know, was a champion of diversity and inclusion. And you know, not that it wasn't those things, and not that I'm not proud of the work that we did, but it just kind of felt like over time it wasn't quite what I had expected it would be for my career. And it became very clear to me that I needed to look onwards, that this would not be my salvation. Yeah. And so that actually was the driving force of me trying to break into Hollywood.
So Hollywood, baby, the Hollywood Hills.
There you go.
And an agent, an agent who you were suspicious of at first.
Uh-huh.
You got to meet him in a coffee shop.
Yes.
You were ripped off by a Spider-Man.
Uh-huh.
The moment you arrived. Do you want to encapsulate those little headlines there?
Well, yeah, it was my first trip down to LA to, you know, my quote-unquote signing meeting with my very first manager. It just was not as glamorous as what you would imagine. Basically, I showed up. I had no money, so I was staying in a hostel off of Hollywood Boulevard. And so, of course, you know, you have these people in Leicester Square, but it's like the dress-ups that, I was passing by in the Spider-Man, you know.
Well,
and
you
I
went
have
to
a
the
soft
Chinese theater straight away.
That's
to get,
right.
Get in the mood, didn't you?
Of course. I was like, Hollywood. Take me to Hollywood Boulevard. I want to see the Walk of Fame. And, of course, it's like, yeah, and I had a soft spot for dress-up superheroes, of course.
It, yeah.
So Spider-Man comes up to me. He's like, let me take a photo of you. And then he grabs my phone, and I'm like, oh, okay. So I take a photo in front of the Chinese theater, and then he turns it around, and he's, you know, taking a selfie with me, and then he's like, that'll be $20 for Spider-Man. And I was like, get the F out of here. And so I came out of that whole experience. That was like my defining interaction right when I first landed in LA. And then, of course, I meet Chris, who's still my manager today, but he was, you know, like 6-7 years ago, he was like just like in a polo and shorts and flip flops. And I was like, oh, like this is not what I expected, like 3-piece suit energy. And, you know, this guy was like,
because you'd been watching too much Entourage.
I had been watching
too much
Entourage.
By the way, you paid Spider-Man $5. You gave him $5.
I did. I've
you sensitive soul.
Oh, yuck.
Right. So so then you had to get out of Canada and you had to get into the States. And the only way you could do that was by applying for the status of alien with unfathomable talent. Or what was the phrase? I can't remember.
Thank you. I much prefer that one. The technical term is, I believe, alien of extraordinary ability.
That's it.
That's the work visa status.
Because of of your job in Canada,
yes,
and Kim's Convenience, you qualified.
Yes. No, a lot of people don't know this. It's you know, Canada and the UK are similar in that we can't just go, you know, take a flight into LA and start auditioning. You need something from the government that allows you to go in and work as a temporary, you know, temporary residents.
Yeah,
so that's, you need to establish notability in your respective field. And how you do that is you engage an immigration attorney, and then you know, I'm really laying down the advice for all the aspiring actors out there. You need all the press that you've done, all the awards and the accolades, and you just need, basically you need to be your biggest advocate, and you need to send that file into immigration services, and they give you a visa and they say, come on in.
Yeah, and what's interesting about, you know, as that sort of journey progressed and you end up at this audition, or you end up at, you're on the eve of the callback to play Shang-Chi, you sort of accidentally organised this massive sporting event, this festival in Canada, because you had become, you had some useful fame, you had a useful amount of fame. I think there's quite an interesting currency in fame, you know, mm-hmm. what's useful at what point. Mm-hmm. And it was really useful for you to sell 100,000 tickets for your event, for you to play basketball with some of your superstar.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. I believe it was more like 1,000 tickets.
I thought it was 100,000.
Oh, thank you. We could go with 100,000.
Okay, I was going to... Sorry, I apologize.
It was a little bit more intimate.
Right, okay. But anyway, sold that in about a second.
Sure.
But then you had to leave your own event, mm-hmm. sort of under cover of darkness, to go back to Hollywood to get the biggest job in the world.
Yes,
yeah. So basically what happened.
That's crazy. And when we were trying to schedule these things out, so yeah, I basically organized this basketball event called the Chinese Canadian Youth Athletics Association Celebrity Classic. And we brought all these, you know, Asian American and Asian Canadian influencers from all over North America. Of course, we set it on the date that Marvel eventually, when they invited me over for a screen test, which was the final audition, fell in the exact same day. So yeah. I did the unfathomable thing of saying no to Marvel. But it wasn't a no. It was like a, pretty please, can you please, please, please move it by just one day so that I can do this event.
Which was a risky call, man.
Man, I know. Especially when you don't have it yet, like you know, you feel like anything you say could change their mind.
Oh.
But thankfully they were very cooperative. And so, well, they were half cooperative. It still meant that I had to fly out at 5 a.m. the next morning. But it was just like, you could not picture
more beautiful. Man, we had to get up at 4 a.m. every morning. Not auditioning for the next Supermodel.
That's true.
Supermodel superhero thing.
That's exactly why I'm not in radio too. But okay. Yeah, it was you could not picture, like, you couldn't write a better sequence of events, because at that night I ended up like sinking the game winning bucket. I had all my friends around me. I had a crowd of 1,000 people cheering me on. And then the next morning I went off and I earned the role of a lifetime.
I love it. So then you bag the role, and then it's going to be announced at Comic-Con. Just could you give us a minute on that, please, if you don't mind?
Yeah, so I mean, Kevin Feige calls me on Tuesday, right? He's like, we want you to be Shang-Chi. And then he's like, in 4 days you're gonna fly down to San Diego, we're going to announce you in front of the crowd at Comic-Con. It's gonna be nuts. And I was like, okay, great. What should I do? Should I dress up? And he was like, no, just come. It's very casual. Just bring you. And so, of course, I show up in San Diego with like $20 skinny jeans from Zara. You know, shout out to Zara. I've got this, you know, I look like me.
Love
I look
Zara.
Like a person. But the first thing that happens when we pull into, so we pull into the Hard Rock Hotel where, you know, all the kind of top talents stay. We pull into the basement, and then the moment my car door opens up, I walk out, and the first thing I see is Natalie Portman passing right in front of me.
Whoa.
And she looks stunning.
Of course.
They're, you know, you're talking like, you know, these guys, they have glam teams and people following them around. It's like a whole production. And so I'm like, Kevin, you, like, he didn't tell me any of this. He was just like, bring, you know, he wanted me to be like the guy that was just being thrown into things,
yeah.
Right? But I was like, oh, Kevin, you done me dirty, Kevin.
Or words to that effect.
Exactly.
So you're on stage, and you're then, there's a great picture in the book, isn't it? You're surrounded by like the most famous people in the world.
The most famous people in the world.
Who are now your pals, and they're embracing you as such because they're so pleased for you. I know a couple of the individuals involved, and they are very giving, very, you know.
Yes.
Very, very, so they're grateful themselves every day. And
absolutely.
they sort of transmit that kind of vibe.
And I think they're keenly aware of this like phenomenon of fame and this kind of the confluence of like the comic book fandom and everything that's happening to them. I mean, it's you don't really know until you're in it. And so what I found is that, you know, everyone in the Marvel universe has been just they've been like, I know what you're going through and I know it's the best thing in the world, but I also know that it's a lot. So don't hesitate to reach out if you ever need anything.
Which is beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So cool. But you get that sense from the films. They're real gang shows.
Yeah.
You get the fact that, or you hope at least anyway, that what's happening on screen, which is so special, you know, regardless of all the brilliant special effects and all the genius involved in that, mm-hmm. you get this chemistry thing. That must be happening off the screen because you can't really get that on unless it's also off.
Well, I mean, I will say each and every one of those actors individually are incredibly talented humans. So I'm sure that even if we hated each other, they would find a way to turn it on for the cameras.
I'm not sure. I'm going to keep my version.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. Everybody, I mean, everyone gets on quite well, and Kevin's really just, you know, he fosters such an incredible work environment.
You know, your book ends on a sort of cliffhanger in a way. I sense another one is in the offing. I can't wait to read it, by the way. It's a great story, man. I know we've only touched on the surface here, but it's such a beautiful story. What do you think is going to happen in the next few years to you in your career and your life?
Well, I'd love to make another one.
Right.
I think there's probably a little bit of demand in the world for that.
I think there might be.
But I think... you know, I think being at this point in my life and in having Shang-Chi, you know, introduced to the world as, you know, the first lead Asian superhero in the Marvel Universe, I think it occupies a very, very unique space. And I think I want to kind of continue to use that platform to be a voice for our community. It's one that historically maybe hasn't been given a lot of visibility, a lot of voice. And so I want to kind of continue to take up space and also to hopefully to open up that space and bring other people on board as well.
Well done. And by the way, the opening fight scene in the bus. I wasn't ready for that because I hadn't seen the movie till yesterday. I watched it. My kids, they love you anyway. I just about had time. After reading the whole of your book, it was like 8 o'clock. I've got to be up in 3 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, I'm going to watch the film. But like the opening scene in the bus, it's like, was that all you?
It was mostly me.
Because you were a stuntman as well, weren't you?
I was, not to any degree that, you know, someone like a Jackie Chan would be, or like a Jet Li.
But to a Bruce Lee degree.
Right, right. No, I was like the substitute stuntman. I was like the guy that you called if your main guy was sick and your second guy was injured. Then they would be like, okay, throw Simu in. Let's see what he could do.
Yeah.
But you
had a bit of previous, useful previous.
I had a bit of physicality, yes, right. Yes. But all credit to our incredible stunt team. I did as much as I could, and as much as they would let me, but you know, at the end of the day, these are big productions, and you know, I was told time and time and time again, if you get injured, everybody loses. Yeah. So that was I still managed to sneak a few in there, though.
Mate, well, you cannot tell. I couldn't see the joint, and I know we're out of time, but just very briefly, how the heck do they make these films? They're so clever, aren't they?
Oh,
I mean,
God.
You're all great. All the acting is fantastic. And there has to be a real connection there. That has to be sort of almost Shakespearean in a way. And often the reason superhero movies are so good nowadays is because there's so much going on that is beyond and of the soul and of the spirit and what's important about life. And that's why they come to life. And there's humor they don't tell themselves too seriously, yet they deal with very serious subjects. And sometimes the best way of all to get that across is with levity and with a light touch and with humor and with a smile. But how the heck do they do all the other stuff?
I think you literally just described it. I would say in Kevin we trust. You know, he's the one guy that's kind of done it time and time and time again. And, you know, it's seeing his confidence and his passion every day. You know, because when he shows up on set, he's just like a kid. He's not the hot, you know, the tired, weary-eyed Hollywood producer that's like, kid, you do too many of these and the business ruins you. He's there and he's like, oh my God, that's so cool. I can't believe you. Oh man, I can't believe the sets look like that. And when you're, you know, fearless leader has that infectious kind of childlike wonderment energy, it's impossible for you not to buy into the process as well.
I wonder what that must be like. Great to meet you, man.
Thank you so much.
You're
for having me.
You're welcome anytime. Great book. This is a great book for you, for the kids to read. It's a great story. It's got some great lessons in it. It's very candid. It's very vulnerable. It's so cool.
Thank you.
Simu Liu, We Were Dreamers, an immigrant superhero origin story.
It's okay. On the New York Times bestseller list.
Why wouldn't it be? I'd be surprised if it wasn't. It would be a crime against literature, my friend.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky.
Virgin Radio.
All right, that's it for now. Thanks for listening. Why not listen back to some of our other podcasts from Matthew McConaughey, Minnie Driver, and Ron Howard. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.